Welcome to the Early Bird Book Club podcast. I'm Deanna Larson with Nashville Public Library. Today we're speaking with Marie Matsuki Mockett. She's the author of Picking Bones from Ash, published by Grey Wolf Press, and it's her debut novel, and it has been shortlisted for the 2010 Saroyan Prize. Marie was born in Carmel, California, to a Japanese mother and American father. And she graduated from Columbia University with a degree in East Asian Studies. Her work often focuses on the intersection between spirituality and materialism in Japan and the United States. I started out by asking Marie about her background and how that informed the writing of her novel, Picking Bones from Ash.
Tell me, Marie, if you don't mind, a little bit about your own background and how it informed writing this story.
Well, let's see. I was born in the States in California, but my mother's from Japan, as in she's born and raised in Japan, and my father's American. It's actually funny. My parents met in Vienna, Austria, and when my father would tell that to people, they would usually say, oh, I didn't know we had a military base in Vienna. And then my father would say, we don't.
Uh-huh.
And then after really awkward silence, he would explain the most romantic story that I've ever heard of how two people met each other ever. They met in standing room at the opera. They were both music students, and my father, being from Nebraska, was 6'2". My mother was 5'2", and was behind him and couldn't see, but he could see her.
Uh-huh.
And so he said, why don't you come and stand in front of me? And that's how they met. And so I grew up, they eventually moved to the States, and I grew up speaking German with both of them because he spoke no Japanese and she spoke no English for a long time. Eventually, you know, my mother and I both learned English.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's
where I came from.
You know, Marie, was your mom in Vienna studying music? Is that right? And your father as well?
Yeah, they were both studying opera. They were both studying voice.
Gosh.
So in the novel, we have one musician who's studying the piano, and I don't really know why I chose the piano as an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
I think because Satomi, the character, is such a fierce individual that I was trying to give her an instrument that that wasn't something where she would cooperate with others, particularly.
Yes, and also it seems like an interesting choice because I think so many Americans are familiar with child prodigies and piano playing.
Right. Yes. There's a lot to say about that.
And that it seems like it's obviously not, I mean, it can be, but it's not a cooperative instrument. It is,
exactly.
you have to be very solitary in your practice, especially.
Exactly.
Which I thought was a really nice tension with her as a child and her mother's ambition for her and then her reluctance. I had piano lessons when I was a child, and I think many of us understand that tension.
Sure.
And isn't it odd, like, I don't understand why, maybe this is my generation, but why the piano, it's like you don't hear about kids saying, oh, my mom made me practice violin. I mean, once in a while, but
yeah.
It seems like the piano seems to be the thing that most parents aspire their children play.
Well, you're so exposed if you play the piano. I guess the idea is that if one plays the piano, then wherever one goes and there's a piano, one can play, whereas the...
Yeah, like the guitar.
Like it takes a, you know, organization, like a group.
Yes, there's something about it that seems really social, but also maybe slightly like a holdover from 19th century idea about good general skills. Like you do needlepoint and you play piano.
Right, we know that from our Jane Austen novels.
I was just going to say, have you ever seen Lost in Austen?
No, I haven't.
Marie, I'm telling you, somebody on a blog recommended it was a British miniseries from 2008, and it's kind of slightly like that book Austenland, where this woman loves Jane Austen so much that she actually enters into the fictional world for a short while.
In the world of my novel,
mm-hmm.
we're dealing with post-war Japan, where... there's a population that is aware of the fact that it's lost the war
mm-hmm.
and wants to be part of the greater world, which means learning to do things the Western way. And one of those things would be music. So that would be part of wanting to learn to play Western instruments, dressing like a Western person.
Mm-hmm.
I remember even in the 80s when I was growing up, when people started to really purchase their own cars. his family members were all learning. Yeah, so Seth and me learning to play the piano would be sort of part of that psychology.
Well, what was it that her mom said something to her like, oh, of course she would be invited to Paris and to further your music studies, but then there was some sort of comment like, and then of course she'll come back and like conquer Japan. Wasn't right. there some sort of thinking? Right. Like-
Yeah. My mother said that she would, my mom actually said she would run into that sort of thinking. Well, going abroad and then coming back and teaching other Japanese how to play the music quote unquote correctly. And certainly with Geidai, the musical university where Satomi goes, I think most people went there planning to become teachers. And so there's a few people who were going to become musical stars. And so the bulk of the teaching was focused on preparing those students to master the Western music and then go out into the, you know, the provinces and teach what they had learned to kind of help spread this knowledge.
Now, Marie, did you sort of take the plot from things that your mom told you about post-war Japan, or were there inklings from your family history and then you did a lot of research, or how did you go about knowing that about the cultural outlook in those years?
I think in terms of filling in the details, a lot of that would have been my memories and thinking back mm-hmm. to what I had observed as a child, mm-hmm. because I did spend quite a bit of time in Japan. Now, in terms of the plot would be a little bit, that's kind of a separate, that sort of uh-huh. came to me separately. But in terms of the details that bring the world to life, I was relying a lot on my memory and my observations. And when something wasn't clear, mm-hmm. I would ask my mother. And she did read the novel and would say to me, well, you have the wrong plant blooming. Or she would say, it's the wrong time of day. Or the train got in at the wrong time of day. There's a scene where Satomi and her mother come to Tokyo for the first time, and my mother said, well, but the train would have them coming in at the wrong time of day, and when they mm-hmm. get in, they'll be hungry, and the mother is a good mother, so she'll want to find something for them to eat, and this is the only place where they would, you know, she was oh, really invest those kinds of details, and so that was really helpful. But I was going to Japan starting in the 70s when I was a really small child, and I was not in the major cities, and there was still a lot of old Japan left over. So there was a lot that I could... And that made quite an impression on me because mm-hmm. undeveloped Japan, of course, is very, very different from the West, the rest yeah. of the year. And so I remembered that my grandparents or my great aunt didn't have a flushable toilet for mm-hmm. a number of years. And, you know, if you were a Westerner going to Japan and you spent most of your time in the cities, you would have seen flushable toilets. I could kind of imagine what it would have been like in the 60s.
Yeah, I found the threads that you draw or you kind of pull through the stories about mothering and being a daughter and what it means to be part of a family. And I think the assumption always is, like, I guess if people think about Japan as a more traditional culture where previous generations are embraced and everybody, and I'm assuming this, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that the elders are embraced and people right. often live together. But then you have these characters that are kind of alienated and cut off
right.
by their own choice or because of circumstances. Why? What was it about this plot that are these sort of anomalies for Japan?
Well, in a very general sense, everybody suffers mm-hmm. all around the world. Mm-hmm. And regardless of what political system or social system people grow up in, there are people who are left out and people who suffer and who, you know, who need their stories mm-hmm. told, I guess. And writers are sort of sensitive people, yeah. you know, looking out to see how other people are feeling. Mm-hmm. So that, I guess that would just be a general statement. And in terms of Japan, I mean, there's a lot that I could say about Japan. I mean, it is a place which has a very old and very, I guess, kind of the impression is that it has a very well-defined way in mm-hmm. which it operates. Mm-hmm. But that does mean then that there are people who are left out, who don't fit into that kind of that way of operating. And that can be a very painful position to mm-hmm. be in. I mean, it was really funny. I remember, it's only recently, for example, that I go to Japan and I see people who might be in wheelchairs. Mm-hmm. who have certain physical disabilities or challenged in certain ways. Mm-hmm. You just simply didn't see them
yeah.
because they weren't out and about. I have a friend who I've known for a number of years, is a friend of the family, who runs I'm not entirely clear on what it is, but it's some sort of mental hospital which caters to people with various ailments. Well, some of them are, you know, are perfectly mentally sound, but aren't physically able. And that was where people would have been put. And so, you know, so that's kind of the underside to a society that from the outside looks like it operates so smoothly. That's not to say that you don't also run into people who are incredibly compassionate and kind. And I'm a person of mixed background, and so I'm always sort of on the lookout for people who don't necessarily fit into a category. So you probably felt my sympathy for that come through.
Yeah, I think, and it just reminds me of Satomi when she goes back. This was heartbreaking to me, and her stepsisters have already taken care of the cremation.
Yeah.
First of all, the nursing of her mom. And as a person, I grew up in Chicago, and I moved down to Nashville for various reasons, and I'm very happy here, but I feel that kind of, not a condemnation from the rest of the family, but sort of like, well, you're not even here, you know, and this is what's happening, right? So the idea that she wasn't there, and I'm not sure that you made it clear to me, or I might have overlooked, you know, why she wasn't able when her mom was calling out for her or wanted or said, is she on her way, why she wasn't able to come?
I think it was supposed to be because the letter that would have told her, that would have told Satomi that her mother was very ill. She missed the letter, basically.
Okay.
Sort of making a point that at one point in time we would have all relied on aerograms and maybe the occasional phone call in order to communicate with each other. But I remember my mother actually became very, very ill when I was 10, and our communication with the family in Japan was all through aerograms, through letters, because the phone was expensive and everybody was too shy to pick up the phone and call. And of course, you know, my mom just got back from Japan. She went to see her father, my grandfather, who's 96.
Mm-hmm.
And I got email from her family saying, hey, we just saw your mom. She's on the Shinkansen going to the airport. Clear day. She'll see Mount Fuji out the window, you know, and then I can track her flight on the internet to see what time she's landing with the plane. I mean, it's a completely different world now than it was 20 or 30 years ago. And one of the things that I did want to play with this novel is the concept of travel and space and what that does to communication.
Mm. It reminds me again of like a 19th century convention, twists of fate, you know, but for a minute and the carriage drives away and the person misses them. There weren't easy ways back then to kind of make up for those things.
No, you couldn't just send a text message. It's true.
You could say, hey, I just missed you. I saw the back of you. And, you know, it was sort of like these things were very final. And the idea that her ability to be there at that important point was just, it just hinged on something like a letter.
Right.
And then the idea that her stepsisters judged her so harshly for that. I really felt that.
Well, yeah, I think that's very, I think that's an aspect of people. It can be an aspect of Japan. I mean, if you were to see me, I don't look 100% Japanese, and yet I remember going to Japan and, you know, my grandfather being very critical, for example, of the fact that I couldn't sit properly on my knees. I was expected to sit correctly, and, you know, nobody was going to cut me any slack for being a foreigner. And so that's not uncommon, and it's certainly not uncommon from people who don't get out of their own country to understand that different people, you know, who, if you're from a different place, that you might do things a little bit differently, and that's, you know, that's got to be okay.
And I liked when Satomi came from Europe and then did have that feeling when she was in the temple, like, oh my God, this is a little bit of a relief. Like, I feel kind of cut off from my background, right? But it's a little bit of a relief that I'm almost like a foreigner now. I've lived abroad for so long. And I could feel, that's one thing that I think that you did so beautifully in this book is I could totally understand the mindset. I could feel exactly what she was feeling in that moment. And I actually felt her relief. And I think there are some such beautiful things about the Japanese culture, but I, as an outsider, feel it's intimidating. I can only imagine having lived away and then coming back and then feeling like you're not quite doing it right, even though it's how you grew up and how alienated she must have felt by that at the same time.
It's a very brave generation that traveled starting in the 60s. even before that, I suppose. But yes, you know, travel was such a almost a sort of a final thing. It wasn't something that you could just do in a week and get over with.
I mean, right, almost like you were deliberately cutting your ties in some way because they would never kind of welcome you as the pure or sort of unadulterated person that you were, because I guess the West was really probably seen as a kind of, not necessarily a totally benign influence. Would you agree with that?
I think it depends on the person. I think there were people who had conflicted feelings about the West. I think there are people who just had a lot of enthusiasm and fascination for it. I think that there were mixed emotions. But yeah. I can also tell you that as a child going to Japan, I was met with lots of enthusiasm too. You know, one never knows on how close you get to somebody.
Yeah, and I felt some of that kind of conflict was embodied by Rumi's eventual profession and what she went into, which was in antiques and artifacts, collector's items. How interesting, you know, there are a couple moments in the novel where you stop and you talk about the nature of truth.
Yes.
And how we hide things. And I thought she obviously loved her father, Francois, but she also was well aware that things were being kept from her. And I got a very distinct sense that she did not feel that this was the way to go forward in life and that it was her job to uncover the frauds,
yes,
to talk to him about why would somebody buy this artifact simply because they like it.
Yeah.
Him being much more cynical about that and feeling like, well, if I am the middleman and that they want to overpay for this piece, who am I to stop them? Whereas it felt like Rumi almost wanted to say to them, hey, wait a second, let me school you in how to tell when something is true.
Right.
Something isn't. And I felt that there were so many layers because of that choice that you made. Now, do you know anyone or do you have a background yourself in that field?
In authentication and antiques. My father was a collector. So he had some friends who were collectors. I would go to auction houses with him. Mm-hmm. And had a lot of fun as a child eavesdropping on people. He expects a kid to eavesdrop on people talking about what's fake or what's real.
Right.
So I was very, very interested in what was real and what was fake. And he was sort of an amateur repair and restorer. Mm-hmm. Nothing nearly as glamorous as what I described in the book.
Right.
And I did, in college, take art history classes and then met a wonderful professor who was teaching Chinese art history at Columbia and let me take his graduate courses, and I would take those with him. So that was sort of my background, and I continue to have an interest in those things. Mm-hmm. But I like this Buddhist idea of seeing through illusion, mm-hmm, and seeing what's real, mm-hmm, and really want to, you know, toy with that. And also I think the idea of understanding what is real and what is really happening becomes even more complicated when you travel to a foreign country. And so that was another layer of complexity that I wanted to add. And challenge for all of us. I mean, I think if you really, really want to challenge yourself, then go someplace completely new where you may or may not understand the language or pick up on everybody's emotional cues. Those are some of the things I wanted to play with.
And I loved how you defended the Buddhists of California. Because I think that they often are held up with a little bit of derision and sometimes, and like as if they're seekers, and just like people in Kabbalah.
Right.
You know, when you're on the outside of it saying, oh my gosh, you know what, you know, Christianity wasn't good enough for them. Now they have to go and try to find, you know, some other tradition. And are they appropriating that? You know, and who was it? Was it Francois or somebody said, you know, it's not like it is in Japan where it is the stuff of rituals at huge milestones in your life. What did you want to say about that? What is your feeling about people?
It's a great question, and I wanted to say all of those things. I mean, I remember in the 80s when Buddhism became really popular. I mean, I guess in the 70s too, but mm-hmm, I really remember hearing about it in the 80s when Buddhism started to become so popular in California.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it is elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Japanese people being very skeptical about this and not understanding what was happening. And yet at the same time, I remember, for example, Japanese people getting married in Japan and recreating what they call the chapel experience. They take an ordinary hotel room, which might be used for any kind of function, and recreating it to look like a quote-unquote chapel. So that the bride and the groom could get married as a quote-unquote Christian couple, even though they aren't Christian.
Oh.
And so it occurred to me, you know, well, we all do this all of the time. And so, yes, perhaps one is appropriating an old spiritual practice.
Mm-hmm.
But why is that a bad thing? And looking at another culture with a fresh set of eyes, you are able to find something new and important and relevant. That's not terrible. Sometimes new religions or spiritual inquiries are absolutely corny and shallow.
Yeah.
But then there are going to be moments when something new and important is revealed.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the answer isn't easy. And I think it's unfair to be dismissive.
And we can't really speak for the motivations of others, but I guess people might be uncomfortable if somebody, like if the Japanese are trying to have the chapel ceremonies because they feel somehow those are better or superior to their own, maybe that's slightly different. But if they find something of value, something that makes them, as you say, see themselves and their own culture through fresh eyes, is that such a bad thing?
Yeah, it's really hard to know. And I mean, you can sort of study history and you can see how religions have migrated
mm-hmm.
and morphed and changed. So this isn't necessarily a new thing. There are things that I've heard that always strike me as corny. I remember one time we had this couple over at our house when I was a kid. He was going on and on about the virtues of the Japanese peasant diet. Oh. And he was a vegetarian.
Huh.
And my mother had made sukiyaki, which is a kind of... Which includes meat. And after his long lecture on vegetarianism and the superiority of the Japanese peasant diet, she finally said, well, what do you think I served you? I served you Japanese peasant food.
Huh?
So there was his perception of what the Japanese peasant diet was supposed to be, which did not include meat. Mad that he had insulted her hospitality, and, you know, A, and B, that he was speaking about something that he didn't know anything. And I just thought, God, there's just so much going on in this conversation.
Oh, right. And I wonder about Timothy. You know, I look at him as a character in the book, you know, eventually becoming, am I right? He was a Buddhist monk. He became,
right.
You know, the idea was he was such a kind of mess and really kind of, maybe we could say he was a guy whose morals were kind of fluid, especially
yes.
with drugs and everything that was going on when he was over in Japan and was involved with Satomi. But, you know, now he's a spiritual leader and a guru.
Right.
You know, and he's over on the west coast of America, and he's kind of leading people. And in some ways, I just think, you know what, that just to me points out that even our spiritual leaders are fallible and they have their own...
Oh, absolutely.
...faults, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
But ultimately, he was like a, I didn't see him as a, at first I thought maybe he would be a bad influence, but I saw him as a kind of interesting, not quite an angel, but a person who was trying to lead, especially Rumi, to truth.
I think it's unclear, but I think a lot of things are.
One of our Early Bird Book Club readers asked why in Japanese culture, when the body is cremated, why the Adam's apple is kept in a separate box?
That's a great question. I think that's a tradition, and it probably has to do with just preserving that special part of somebody's voice mm-hmm. and that particular individuality that they have.
Tell me about the belief that the person who has passed away, that there are certain times of the year and certain days when they come back. Is it that they need that to speak on those days, or is it really not connected with that at all?
Oh, do they need the voice?
Yeah, do they need the Adam's apple?
I don't think that they're connected. I think that the days of the year when the spirits are supposed to, well, they're, to be completely accurate, they're supposedly 3 days of the year. There are the two equinoxes, around the times of the two equinoxes,
right.
Where, you know, that kind of makes sense, right? That the equinoxes would have special, the spring and the winter would have special meaning. I'm sorry, yes. Summer and the winter. You know what? I'm sorry, it's spring and fall.
Oh, spring and fall. Okay, which are, those are the transition seasons, so it seems like that.
Yes, right. You'd think it would be summer and winter.
Right.
Well, so the I guess the barrier between the spirit world and our world is supposed to be thin.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also Obon, which is takes place either in July or in August, which is a tradition that comes from China, which is different, where the spirits are supposed to come back. So, you know, there are all ways for people to go to the cemetery and clean the cemetery and remember the dead and do things for them, which are quite beautiful, really.
I think it's the Western monk, I forgot his name, the one who sort of meets Satomi and kind of takes her hand and when she comes for her mother's service, and they have the conversation about how nice it is that that the bones are just left, like the ground is hard and they cannot be buried. But
what was so strange is I wrote all of that, and about a year and a half ago, my father passed away.
Oh.
And I had already written this. And so my dad died in June of 2008. So that was my first experience with really having his body go from the hospital morgue
mm-hmm.
to be cremated. And then my mother and I went and picked up his ashes, you know, in this little small box. Mm-hmm. And so I had written all of this stuff about really having had that.
Right.
So it was very strange when I had to edit the manuscript and go back. And I thought, oh, yes, it is very different.
Yeah.
And much less stark.
And the idea of keeping that person with you,
yeah,
versus
yeah.
putting them in the ground, and then that is a very different thought process about what happens to that spirit and where that,
yeah,
right, and visiting graves versus visiting bones or visiting crypts versus having the little box with you in whatever special place that you keep it in. It's just, I liked how that made, as a reader, it made you really think about Western traditions and why do we do it like that, and how it's not creepy at all for the Japanese to think about having their loved ones with them in that way.
Well, I still think, and this is something that I'm going to write about at some point. I mm-hmm. did write an essay on cremation in Japan, but
oh.
I've been asked to work on a project having to do with ghosts and ghost stories.
Mm.
And I really, there's a little interview which I say that I really think that ghosts and ghost stories in Japan, and probably other parts of Asia too,
mm-hmm.
are the scariest stories because they're very personal. And, of course, that's part of what I was trying to get at with my book. Here in the West, what would be scary to us would be the devil, right? With this Judeo-Christian framework, we're all subjected to original sin, so the devil is the thing that scares us the most.
Mm.
Japan didn't go through that same sort of religious development.
Right.
So the scariest thing would be insulting an ancestor,
mm.
or somebody to whom you have a personal connection, who you didn't take care of well enough.
Yeah.
Who's then going to come back and get you? It's a very personal attack if a ghost is in your face.
Wow.
Devil, which is a very sort of general evil. So I don't know. So I just find that really, really interesting. A very, very original idea that I had for this book was that I wanted to write a ghost story. Of course, it then went into many other directions. In Japan, is to run into a ghost.
Gosh. Yep. You know, that's obviously a smaller part of the book, but
right.
it is one of the most memorable parts. And I guess as a Western reader, I didn't really make that connection in such a strong way that this is your ancestor that you're trying to reach. And you're
right.
trying to listen. Are they trying to tell me something? And in the Christian tradition, you want to believe like your grandparents are looking down on you or saying
right.
a prayer for you. But it's not such a feeling like my grandma might be standing at the end of my bed next week and she might have a little message for me. But I find that really comforting.
It is kind of comforting. And I think, as I said, I lost my father a year and a half ago. I was very, very close to my dad. I think only when you've experienced that kind of intense grief do you understand that desire to want to maintain a connection with somebody who's not there physically. And you can see how a culture would develop that would try to help preserve that link and why that might not be so unhealthy.
Do you have a feeling that your dad talks to you?
In a way, absolutely. Mm. Yeah, sure. I mean, particularly, I would say in the first year, I would wonder, I would worry about something, or I'd be having a problem, and somebody would say something, and I would think, oh, that's what Daddy would say. Really interesting.
Yeah, and not always like people imagine. Obviously, ghost stories, the ghost has to have some sort of figure or some visual, right. But yeah. I don't think it's always as simple as they come to you and you see them as much as you feel their presence.
Right. And it's hard to understand what a relationship with somebody is anyway, because it's not a physical thing that you can track. You know, it's something that's going on in your mind. And so I don't know what all of that means.
Yeah. Well, I'm just wondering, as we're talking, I mean, this is really fascinating, and I think this is a lot of the heart of the novel, you know, talking about these connections and how they're not tenuous at all. They're very strong, even though they might span oceans and generations, but that you feel them as if they are very tangible. And I'm wondering if that's why it seems like in Japan, people do honor artifacts that stand for this other realm, you know, and they respect these items as totems of this other sort of parallel kind of experience.
It's funny, in the last couple of months, I've developed and started teaching a little lecture on Japanese fairy tales, partly based on reading that I've done, you know, that other people, reading books by other people, and then also sort of my own thoughts. I would say a couple of things. And one of the points that I make about Japanese fairy tales is the boundary between the spirit world and the human world is very thin. So spirits pop up, people go to other places. It happens all the time. And if you read Japanese contemporary fiction or any of this anime and manga, which has become so popular, or see these Hayao Miyazaki films, then you're aware of that kind of attitude towards storytelling. And I would say that it comes partly because this is sort of my opinion, you know, Japan is still in some ways an animistic place. Even if people don't practice Shinto, which is the indigenous religion of Japan, even if they practice Shinto more out of habit or out of kind of a cultural norm than they do out of deep belief, right. I still feel like Shinto, and I guess I should back up and say, so Shinto is the indigenous religion of Japan, and it is believed that Shinto is populated by over 8 million gods and demons that can inhabit rocks and trees, etc. And this is still very much a part of Japanese culture. I could say to you, for example, just to try to make the point clear, I myself am not baptized. I'm up in the West, and I'm fully aware of the fact that there's kind of a Judeo-Christian slant to my thinking, just as a result of being part of this culture that I value, that are important to me because I'm a child of the West. So it's kind of the same thing in Japan. You know, the people don't necessarily believe in Shinto with this great faith, but it still informs the culture. And Shinto itself is kind of an animistic religion. Yes. I think that that's one of the reasons why, yes, people do believe in good luck charms. I also think it's one of the reasons why it's so important in Japan that things are beautifully designed, that food is so beautifully presented. Things are alive, imbued with a particular sort of charm or beauty that comes with being alive. It's an inanimate object. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, I have long admired the Japanese aesthetic, you know, just the look of how beautifully things are done and designed, and the thought that goes into every, you know, if you look at a wood block, you know, the simplest of lines, but they seem almost animated with the spirit of the person.
That's right. It's very important.
That they gave of themselves their own spirit, and then it is now imbued, this item is imbued. And it reminds me, remember when you were talking about Satomi and her mom, or I can't remember who went to that restaurant, and they had the sashimi that was
glistening like jewels or something.
Well, that you talked about how they arranged it. It's so incredible, but they arranged it to look almost as if the fish obviously has been filleted, and it's arranged to look as if it's leaping out of the stream.
I mean, I have a friend in Japan who is a wonderful chef and grew up in one of these very high class kaiseki restaurants. And I think that, you know, the basic idea is that if something looks beautiful, then it's going to taste better.
Yes,
the presentation matters.
To such an elaborate degree,
Japan's an extreme place. It's a harsh place, and a lot of beautiful things come from harsh and extreme concentration. And not everything is like that. It's also a very playful culture with a wonderful street culture too. But when you look at the high arts, absolutely, there's just a very, very extreme attention to detail.
Here's a question from a reader, Marie. And she says, I am savoring this book, and I am intrigued by the character Shinobu Kaneshiro. I am Korean, and my father is old enough to remember the Japanese occupation of Korea and each family being required to take a Japanese surname. Point out in the book, Shinobu uses her Japanese name during the competition, but wears a traditional hanbok.
Yes.
An obvious clue to her ethnicity. In Satomi's mind, and judging by the audience's response, Shinobu was the best pianist, but why did Satomi win and Shinobu not even play? Is the reader to surmise that the judges were prejudiced or that Satomi did not even realize the depth of her own talent?
Oh, gosh, what a great question. I think I was thinking that the judges were prejudiced, but it's all, I mean, it's possible that maybe Satomi didn't realize how talented she was.
What?
But I was sort of thinking that judges just didn't want to award a prize to the Korean girl.
Another reader asks, why did Satomi not take Rumi with her when she left?
I think there are a number of reasons. I mean, I think Satomi wasn't ready to be a mother. I think, Rumi would have been a child of mixed heritage in Japan, which would have been a challenge. I downplayed that, but that would have been part of her reasoning. I think she felt that Rumi would always be, there's some line where Satomi says something about how Rumi would have always been aware that Satomi was hiding something and that she hadn't become a mother because she wanted to be. Her own drive, I guess, to pursue her, to fulfill this dictum that she'd be a talented person was stronger than anything else, stronger even than being a mother. A lot of people, I mean, people have difficulty with that choice. Hard.
I mean, I think even in modern day, I still hear women discuss this and argue this and try to figure this out for themselves. Like it seems like even though we're told that women can have it all, it seems like a woman of the level that Satomi's mom wanted her to be in terms of a musician would have negated any possibility of her being a traditional wife and mother.
Right. Well, and remember, Satomi's not in San Francisco because she necessarily wants to be. There's something that has happened to her. And at a certain point, she decides, wait, I need to take control of the situation and fix it.
Yeah.
And it has been very interesting. Of course, I have a number of friends who are creative, but I've got a lot of writer friends who will not have children. And when I wrote the novel, I wasn't thinking about having kids or getting pregnant or writing the novel, and I was fully aware of the fact that even now I hear a lot of women say, well, I don't want to have children. It's going to get in the way of my writing. I don't know that I can be a decent parent, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Writers don't typically make a lot of money. It's hard for us to hire help or
Yes. Kids.
You know, it's sort of an impractical decision.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's such an uncommon problem to have. And certainly there are stories all the time of people who abandon their kids or decide not to be parents. And it was interesting, there was an editor who liked my novel but said, I can't stand the fact that Satomi made that choice, so I don't want to publish a book.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm serious. She felt very strongly about it. And I thought, well, that's interesting because it's not, I don't think it's an uncommon problem to have.
No.
There's talk.
Well, I think there's certainly taboo, and I can bet in almost all societies there's taboo and harsh judgment for a woman who would give up her child or children. But
yeah.
There are plenty of reasons why a woman might need to do that. But it's like not, it's accepted that a man might go off.
That's right.
But it's not as accepted that a woman would go off.
That's right.
So another reader had a question that's very much connected to that. Satomi had a rough childhood due to her unknown father and cruel stepsisters. Why did you decide that she would leave her daughter, especially after experiencing all that trauma of her less than ideal childhood herself?
Well, I think there are a couple of answers. I mean, here's the writer answer, which is that I didn't decide, right? It was what felt correct for the character. So I couldn't just make her do what I wanted her to do. I will tell you that there are several answers I have. So there's that answer.
Yeah.
Then there's the fact that over the years I've met a number of people who, like me, are products of an international marriage, interracial and international marriage.
Right.
Where the relationship falls apart because one of the parents isn't able to acclimate to the other country. Mm-hmm. I mean, even Barack Obama's father left, raised by his mother.
Uh-huh.
The father's not able to be part of this relationship or the culture or anything,
mm-hmm.
and leaves. It's not an uncommon problem. that one of the parents, and you're right, it's generally the father, not the mother, but one of the parents simply can't adapt culturally, mm-hmm. and whatever connection or love exists between the two people isn't enough to keep the family together. Psychologists would look at Satomi and say, well, she sounds like she's suffering from some sort of postpartum and did not bond with this child once the child was born. And I've seen enough female artists with kids and watched them really wrestle with this question of wanting to do something creative versus raise a child, and really struggled. Somehow being maternal somehow feels too vulnerable or something. And I think we get that from Satomi, that she has tremendous difficulty being truly intimate or close to another person, having any sort of emotional intimacy, let alone with a child, particularly when she hadn't fulfilled her mother's ambitions for her.
Yeah.
So all of those reasons. Now, another person, of course, would be in that predicament and have a child and think, I'm going to raise this child correctly. I'm going to make up for, you know, everything that went wrong in my life. But that's not Satomi's character, and that's made her, you know, very unpopular with some people.
One reader said, why didn't we ever find out who Satomi's father was, and why did her mom turn into the person she did when she married?
Yeah, that's a great question. I had it in my head who Satomi's father was, but I also felt the novel was long enough without adding yet another layer of covering in mystery. And I'm not going to tell you because I might write it someday. It's part of another novel.
I would love that.
So that's A. But I did have his backstory in mind. And I think we're also supposed to understand that Akiko, Satomi's mother, mm-hmm. did come from an intact family mm-hmm. that would have been torn apart by the war, but which is just sort of hinted at, mm-hmm. the kind of the chaos that the war caused. But that she had enjoyed being a child of a somewhat privileged family mm-hmm. and had enjoyed being part of a family.
Right.
And then when she got the chance to be part of one again, it was hard to mm-hmm. not enjoy that.
I don't want to keep you much longer, but I was just wondering if you, who your favorite writers are, and did you use a book or a film or something as a kind of model for how you wanted to have your first book turn out?
I feel like a lot of people, my sense of storytelling, I probably imprinted on fairy tales. As a kid, my mother would read Japanese fairy tales with me, and I would read Western fairy tales with my father.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of feel like those are things we never get away from in terms of understanding how a story is to unfold.
Yes.
Japanese fairy tales are very different from Western fairy tales. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I've been doing this little analysis of the two that I presented to people, and I don't think that I realized until recently how much that impacted me. It's also I really love the myth of Psyche, which is the story of a mortal woman in love with a god who goes off and tries to find the truth. That's always resonated with me really strongly, that girls in fiction often are the ones who are out there battling to try to find out what's really happening to be our story, you know, what's happening on a psychological level. And Rumi's the one who kind of puts it all together as well as she can.
What would you want readers to take away from this story?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I hope that it was, we've talked about all of this high-level stuff, but I hope that it was an adventure in reading. I know that as a reader, I still really love reading a book that transports me or mm-hmm. makes me feel like I went on a journey someplace. There's something that reading a book can do that no other medium can really do. You can enter into an imaginary world. Yes. So I hope that people would have that feeling. We can do things in fiction that we can't do in real life with snow and demons. And I would hope that all of that was transporting in some way.
Absolutely. I think the style is exquisite, and I think the story is absolutely captivating. And I'm very, very grateful to you that you allowed us to pick it for the Early Bird Book Club. I think the readers absolutely were entranced. And I hope that, by posting the podcast, that we can encourage other people to definitely look up Picking Bones from Ash.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. It was really fun to have a chance to talk about the book to this degree.
We so look forward to your next book, and also, do you have a website where we can kind of keep up with your essays and other work?
Sure, it's just mariemockett.com. And Picking Bones from Ash, the novel, has its own website and also has book club questions, which I wrote. They're just questions that I thought might be interesting for people to think about. Thanks to everybody who read the book and put such thought and care into the questions.